Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, three finalists for the 2026 Nebula Awards discuss their craft, why they write, and the state of speculative fiction today. Moderated by Tananarive Due, Toastmaster of the 2026 Nebula Awards, which are given annually by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association. This program was part of the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our final program at the American Writers Festival. Thank you guys for coming today. This has been so much fun. I'm really excited about this program. It's presented in partnership with the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association. The Nebula Awards recognize the best works of speculative fiction published in the United States. We are thrilled to have the Toastmaster of the 2026 Nebula Awards, Tananarive Due, with us to present three of the award's finalists. Amy Chu is a multi-genre writer for graphic novels and animation. Her most recent book is the Nebula Award nomination. They're all here, just like right by me, so I'm just like, oh, we'll call them on at once. But Amy Chu is a multi-genre writer for graphic novels and animation. Her most recent book is the Nebula Award-nominated Carmilla the Eternal, which is the final chapter in the award-winning Carmilla the First Vampire trilogy. Somto Ihezue is a writer and filmmaker. He's an MFA fellow in creative writing at the University of Maryland. He writes about boyhood, land, disruption, and joy in Igbo communities. Annalee Newitz writes science fiction and nonfiction. They are the author of four novels, Automatic Noodle, The Terraformers, The Future of Another Timeline, and Autonomous, which won the Lambda Literary Award. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage.
Hey, hey! Have we all recovered from the Nebula Awards last night? So it was quite a wonderful ceremony, a communal opportunity to sort of take a break from all the noise and the wind outside and celebrate that thing we love, which is writing. And one of the themes in my Toastmasters speech was on the role of the artist and how very often as artists we begin to feel helpless, pointless even sometimes when the temperature gets turned up enough in terms of politics and in terms of economic hardship. So I guess I wanted to just have an informal chat with the panelists about how it is you feel your writing in particular helps you both disengage and engage with the noise outside.
Okay, I'll start. Tananarive is looking at me expectantly. Well, I'm in a kind of an interesting position because I started out my career as a journalist. I continue to do science journalism. My nonfiction work focuses on technology and science. And I came into fiction writing through that door. So I had been accumulating a lot of stories in the back of my mind about researchers and ideas that I couldn't put into journalism, sometimes because the researcher would ask me not to, sometimes they would be kind of skirting the law in their work a little bit to get around, not to do things that were terrible, like experiment on human beings, but more like to, say, break copyright on various pieces of software, that kind of stuff, things that don't harm anyone. And so I started writing fiction partly to tell the stories about scientists and people working in technology that I couldn't tell because I'd get people in trouble. And in fiction, I find that you can really, you can tell stories that are in some ways much more honest and true than you can in journalism because you can bring in those political issues that don't always belong in journalism. If I'm just reporting on a new development in how robots can swim, bringing in issues around grant money or like around the politics of the scientists doesn't always fit. but in fiction, it really does. And so I think for me, I often say that my brain switches back and forth between reporting as accurately as possible and then making things up. And I actually understand the difference between them, which is great. That doesn't always happen in the world of journalism, especially right now. But making things up gives us a chance to really show context for a lot of real world things, whether it's science or politics. And we get to elicit empathy for the people who are doing the work and leading the story forward. So for me, it's an incredibly important outlet to have, to be able to have that political engagement openly and honestly in my work.
I would say I found my storytelling becoming more of a demand, kind of like demanding things of me and like demanding bravery of me, demanding truth of me. I'm coming from Nigeria. I've just lived in the US for 2 years. But just thinking back to Nigeria and thinking about certain laws that put people in jeopardy, particularly queer people in jeopardy, imprisons queer people, and thinking about the kind of media or the kind of storytelling that I grew up seeing about queer people, one that villainizes queerness, even in terms of spirituality, one that villainizes Igbo spirituality, traditional forms of spirituality. And it's easy to not engage with those things. And at the same time, I'm not saying every writer's work should become political, but art is political. And I think through my work, through storytelling, I just find ways to at least tell the truth as best as I can, or to rewrite as best as I can. In terms of, I was recently speaking with a bunch of other Nigerians, queer Nigerians, and we talked about how most of the storytelling about queerness in Nigeria comes from a place of pessimism, of tragedy, of sadness. And that is people's lived realities, but at the same time, you can also see that there is joy to be found. There are people who are living loudly, living boldly, living courageously, despite the odds stacked against them. And we need to tell those stories. Those stories need to be heard to give people hope. And through storytelling, we can do that. Through storytelling to speculative fiction, we get to do that. Through science fiction, through fantasy, we get to do that. And I would say in these times, storytelling has been demanding bravery and courage of me.
I was thinking about what Annalise said earlier, and I think it's true that what I write, it's storytelling, but it's also much more honest in telling the truth. I was not, you know, I'm Chinese American. I was not raised to be incredibly introspective, you know. For me, writing, and if any of you read the Carmilla trilogy, it's really the story of Chinese American immigration, right? Cloaked under, you know, sapphic vampirism, right? So you can read it on one level, but if you're reading it, you are going to get a history and also inadvertently some of my own family history in there, right? So I think that it's therapy for me. And there's a certain honesty in being, it's, you know what, it's not even honesty, it's a scaffolding, right? It's a way that I can tell a story. I'm not an autobiographical writer. I don't think I could do that, but I am doing it through fiction, and it makes me feel like I can actually contribute to some understanding, especially for other people who may be like me, or there is some intersection of that story that touches them.
Last night, while I was the Toastmaster for the Nebulas, I learned I had won a Bram Stoker Award for an essay called Why I Write Horror, which is... Thank you. I didn't mean it as an applause line, but thank you so much. But I really wanted to use that as a way to segue into what the topic of that essay was sort of the difficult journey I had toward genre because of pressure I felt against writing genre. And you all may have had different experiences culturally, I don't know, but I wonder, in my case, because I'm the daughter of civil rights activists who are very serious-minded about doing real-life world-building, which we will talk about, I didn't know that writing horror would bring respect to my family name. Even though my mother loved horror, she introduced me to horror, but I still felt this genre bias in my writing classes and this internal pressure to do weighty work. And I had to really fight the feeling that that would not be weighty work, which luckily I have let that feeling go. I'm wondering what your journeys have been like, specifically because the Nebulas are about speculative art. How has your journey been with your relationship with genre and your permission to feel that your work is of importance?
Oh my God. This is turning into autobiographical confessional. So actually, I feel quite good in a lot of ways because I think I did everything I was supposed to do as a good second generation Chinese American, as a female, and I did the things I was supposed to do. I went to MIT. I got my master's from Harvard. I got a decent job. I married a good Chinese man. I had pumped out two kids. And so I did everything, right? I mean, I'm being totally honest here. And then I got sucked into the world of comics, right? But at that point, I had already done everything. Nobody cares. I already did everything. So it was very freeing because I did this much later in life. I started writing when I was 44. So people are like, what do your parents think? It's like, I don't care what they think. I'm 44. I'm writing comics because I want to write comics and I want to tell my stories. So it is very freeing at a certain point. I probably could have done it a lot earlier, to be honest. And I think that's an important message. If you have that story in you. But to be honest, I didn't have that story in me. It just came out later. Then I suddenly realized, wait, I really want to do this. And the honesty and the ability to suddenly realize I could do it in this format, I don't think I could have done it in a different format. So that journey, so it is a journey, right? I've sort of lived 9 lives in a lot of ways. I did what I was supposed to do, so there was that. And I didn't have to, right? But I didn't have to do this kind of soul searching or anything. It was just kind of, I was just trying to help my friend who was a dutiful Chinese American daughter who rejected that. And I said, you do you, I'm gonna support you. And she dragged me into it. So in an alternate universe, I would still be doing biotech business development, not doing any of this.
I think anyone who's familiar with like Nigerian parenting can relate to how there are only 3 things you can possibly be. You have to be a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer, and that's literally all of it. And my own case was also funny because I grew up in Onitsha, and Onitsha is a town in Nigeria that we have the largest market in West Africa. Every street has a market in Onitsha, and what that demands of the people living in Onitsha is that you have to be a trader and something else. So you be a trader and a doctor, a trader and a lawyer, a trader and a scientist, but you just have to be a trader. You have to trade in something. My mother was a banker and a trader. My father was a trader and a trader. My sister was a pageant queen and a trader. So you had to be something and a trader, and I have 0 trading abilities. And I was like, oh, I want to write. And I was like, what is that? Like, what are you talking about? You're going to starve. No one will marry you. I think I'm grateful to the teachers I had, the English teachers I had, who would always say, oh, I see what you're doing. I like what you're doing. And they would always say those things to me when I was growing up, when I was writing maybe like my essays or the little stories I was writing back then. But yeah, I think that was one of the core struggles I remembered with choosing. I ended up actually falling to the pressure because I ended up studying biochemistry in university and also started looking for something to trade in. I was like, my mom was like, since you like books, maybe sell books. And then when it came to the writing itself, and then I started to interrogate the fantastical in Igbo culture, is to interrogate Igbo spirituality, is to reclaim Igbo spirituality. And currently, Nigeria is a very especially the part of Nigeria I come from, it's very the faith is very Eurocentric, it's very Christian. And what that means is that Igbo spirituality is demonized and villainized. But to be a writer of speculative fiction, an Igbo writer of speculative fiction, is to reclaim Igbo spirituality. And me doing that was something that was also, well, not considered good. Yeah. I had a cousin who actively abandoned Christianity to practice Igbo traditionalist, to be an Igbo traditionalist. And he was ostracized from our community. And I was like, am I next? But yeah, I think those are the I would say, that have the struggles have been laid across my path as a writer of speculative fiction, but we are still here, so.
I like how all of us in some way struggled to be like the good kids that our parents wanted us to be. I was raised by two Jewish parents who definitely also wanted me to either be a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer would have been okay too. I remember my mom telling me when I was a kid, you're so good with your hands, you could be a dentist. And it was also, there was also a kind of a class issue in our family. My father was the first kid in his family to ever go to college. And he came from, it wasn't, I think the stereotype of a Jewish family is that they're all very learned, but my dad's family were all like arsonists and grifters and criminals of various kinds. And so he felt like he didn't really want to go into the family business. And so he considered education to really be his salvation. And so what he really wanted for me was to get more education than he'd gotten. And so I had a lot of pressure. Both my parents were English teachers. So when they found out I was reading science fiction, they were like, that's okay until you're like 14, and then you should stop reading science fiction. It was a whole thing in our household that there was, they really wanted me to stop and reading SF and start reading literature. And they really wanted me to get a PhD in English because they felt like that would give me like a place in the world, because no one could anticipate what happened to academia in the 1990s and the 2000s when I was trying to get a job, which was that there were no jobs. It was actually the most economically unstable position I could have chosen for myself. But I did try to be a good kid. I got my PhD in English. I learned about literature. But I very quickly, while I was in grad school, I discovered Star Trek because of my English my English major family and my literary parents. We didn't have a TV growing up. That's not true. We had one black and white TV in the closet, which we would take, it would come out of the closet only for us to watch Monty Python and the Marx Brothers. And that was sort of how I learned about being Jewish, was from the Marx Brothers. And then I learned about the world from Monty Python and science fiction. So, but while I was in grad school, I discovered television, and I discovered Star Trek, and that was when my parents and I parted ways, because I wound up writing my dissertation about monsters in pop culture, which did not get me an academic job, but did help me find my way into journalism, and my parents never approved of what I did, and always wished that I had, you know, done something more literary. So that's too bad for them. But I think for me, as I was saying earlier, for me, fiction was a place where I could tell the truth and feel comfortable. And I've always felt most comfortable in a science fictional world building in place. I've always felt a little bit like an alien or maybe a robot. I write a lot about robots. And I think part of that comes from being from growing up in a house where I was told what to do all the time with my brain, like that this is what you will do with your brain, this is the right stuff to put in your brain, and it felt very much like being a little robot who was being programmed, like, yes, you will run Linux, and that is it. And you will not be allowed to run one of those cheesy mainstream operating systems like, you know, iOS or Windows. I'm sorry, this is like deep cut computer jokes. but at any rate, I think that was part of what brought me into science fiction, was feeling like a bit of an alien robot.
I love all those answers. So one of the things I mentioned in my speech at the Nebulas last night is that when I was in college, I told my writing workshop that my favorite authors were Toni Morrison and Stephen King. And there was this communal clenching that happened when I mentioned Stephen King's name because they couldn't believe, what, a commercial, you know, horror. And earlier today at this very conference, Daniel Krauss was in a workshop on adaptation. He just won a Pulitzer Prize for a novel that is very firmly in the realm of horror fantasy and speculation. And I wonder, I know this is probably a round robin conversation. Beloved, I believe, also won the Pulitzer many years ago. But it feels to me that speculative fiction is crossing over in a more significant way and gaining respect among both readers and critics, because Whalefall, Daniel Krauss's previous novel, was on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, and I thought, what? How did he do that? That's incredible. So do you share that perception that the respect for genre and the impact of genre is being better understood and embraced both by readers and by critics? First of all, do you accept that premise? And if you do, why do you think it is? Whether it's about the work itself or about the interaction of work and the times we're living in.
I definitely think it is. I'm curious what you guys think. But I do think that now we're seeing just a lot more speculative fiction crossing over with literary fiction. I don't know if that's been your experience, because I know you're more literary than me. And
yeah. Well, if you insist, I'll. But no,
I. Those roots as a poet. That's what it is.
Well, coming from a Nigerian background, the core of the writing society, the writers we grew up knowing back in Nigeria, Wole Soyinka, Chinua Achebe, these were writers who were considered literary, even though their works navigated the speculative in one way or the other, but they were considered heavily literary writers. And the works that I would say informed what would be called the speculative was the folklore, the traditional stories, and those are obviously being villainized, so no one wanted to interrogate with them in that way. But we still have writers like Nnedi Okorafor coming to the scene, Wole Talabi coming to the scene, and now being considered, and just talking about that crossover, I think for the longest time I was skeptical about applying to an MFA program because I was being told MFA programs do not accept writers who write genre. I would see applications that would outright state, if you write genre, do not apply here, like word for word. And I would still apply there anyways. And of course, and of course they didn't accept me. But I've also seen that rise where it's like, oh, we want more slipstream. We want work that bends genre. You can say magical realism, you can say the fantastical, you can say science fiction, but they don't want to say that. But I would say that, like, I also agree that, and we've always been here, we've always been writing, we've always been telling these stories, and these stories have always mattered. But I can't really speak to why exactly we are seeing that shift. I'm sure there's a plethora of reasons why we are seeing that shift now. Even in academia, my MFA program, every single one of us writes the speculative. And if anyone wants to apply, can apply to the University of Maryland. It's a very great program. They didn't pay me for promo, but yeah.
I have some thoughts. I have a theory a little bit. It's not just my theory, but that I think that technology has a lot to do with the shift in things. I mean, some of you remember when we only had 3 channels on TV, and now we have, what, 1,000? And plus digital, whatever, even books, right, were originally just printed, and now we have audio, digital. And I think with the proliferation, every time we have a technology jump, in my opinion, it makes for more ways where we can express ourselves. And those expressions can gain traction and form genre and subgenre. And so I think, in my opinion, I think there's a bit of that going on, right? So we're seeing now, this is the first time I heard of hope punk. I didn't realize it was called hope punk. Murder bot is part of that subgenre. all things are valid, but there's certain things that are now coming to life in terms of expression that were not possible 20 years ago, right? I teach at the School of Visual Arts. I teach artists how to write, and they can express themselves in so many different ways, right? You can make a zine. You can go do an Instagram comic. You can write. There's a lot of different ways that they can now create stories, and I think that has added to, you know, some of what we're seeing now, right? Whether or not people consider it valid or literary, but we're destroying a lot of these things because those are kind of old ways of thinking. And now we have so many different stories, like all of you can create your own stories, right? And that wasn't necessarily available to you. Sure, you can draw on a cave wall, but how many people are going to see it on the cave wall, right? But now you put it on TikTok and there you go.
I was going to just add one thing to the question of why. And it reminds me of this quote that's burned into my mind from Hunter S. Thompson, who is a problematic fellow, but this is a great quote. He says, "When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro." And I think that's part of what happens, is that as our reality becomes super weird, whether because it's inundated with technology that bombards us with tons of messages, or it becomes weird politically, I think we need speculative fiction to make sense of it, to actually, in a sense, to tell a realistic story, you almost need an element of fantasy or horror or science fiction for it to make sense.
Just to keep pace with reality, yeah. Actually. So last night, after the ceremony, I got a message from someone on Instagram who'd been a survivor of a children's prison called the Dojo School for Boys, which was the setting for my fictional novel, The Reformatory. And he was letting me know how unburdened he felt by the fact that I had written, like he'd felt for years that he had some responsibility to write the story, but now I had done it. What a relief. And I was just so struck by that. And you all have been recognized now. The Nebula is obviously a very important award and organization in CEFWA. So you have that external recognition, but when did you know, maybe the first time or maybe the most impactful time you remember realizing that your work wasn't just for you? You know, it wasn't just you venting or it wasn't just your creativity or your outlet, but that it had landed with a reader or readers. Do you have a moment that jumps out when you realized, wow, this really mattered?
Yeah, I will go because this is probably the reason I'm still a writer. At first, it's like you get short stories. You can't really make a living off of short stories. And you're not entirely sure whether you're successful at it, right? And I had written, this was one of my very first stories, and it was under the Vertigo imprint when it was still around. And I'd written a near future story set in Detroit. And it was an 8-page story. And I'm well aware of all the tropes about Detroit, and I wanted to do a twist on that, that it was near future Detroit that was very successful, because I had met somebody who's like, no, it's you know, Detroit, there's a lot of investment going to Detroit. And I was like, why are we not portraying it that way? This is a media problem, right? And so I wrote a story set like that, and I was at a Comic-Con, and nobody knew who I was. I really only had a couple short stories, and when I was packing up at the end of the convention, a person ran up to me and said, "Oh my gosh, are you Amy Chu?" And this is my first fan interaction where they're like, that was such an important story to them because they were a Detroit native, and this was the first time they're reading a positive sci-fi story about Detroit, centered like that, right? And that was the moment I was like, oh my gosh, first of all, someone actually read it. Because my family doesn't read my stories, you know? They had read it, and it really made a difference to them to the point where they're willing to try to track me down. I was like, wow, I guess I should keep doing this?
I would say I think with this story, that was a finalist for the Nebulas, which was a far future story about a group of young children trying to save the fireflies in their community. And there's always this this little bit of like backlash towards Nigerian science fiction writers from the, not like a backlash, but it's always like side talk about like, oh, we're pandering. Nigerians, why is there an Igbo man in space? As if Igbos or Nigerians don't belong in the future. So I think there's also the conversation about, when it comes to also like talking about queerness in Nigeria and the idea, which is, and I, the writers who are writing about the lived reality of queer people in Nigeria and how it's tragic to be queer in Nigeria. And that's the truth. But in my stories, I try to, as much as I can, because I've seen those stories so many times, and they are very important stories of identity. They are super important. They need to be told. People read them, and people can, and it's just really important. But at the same time, it was like, regardless of all this hate, regardless of all this tragedy, there is also joy to be found there. I have seen the joy here. And that is the story I want to see. That's the kind of story I want to write. I want to see queer people being happy. I want to see queer people just being fully themselves in Nigeria, not just anywhere, but in Nigeria. I want to see Igbo queer people. And so I wrote a story about Igbo queer people who are saving fireflies in their communities. And someone reached out to me on Instagram, and they were like, oh, I read the story, and it was just, he said it was the most beautiful, as a queer person, it was the most beautiful thing he had ever read, especially him also being an Igbo person. And that was very important to me, that it was coming from an Igbo person, it was coming from a Nigerian, because if there's anything the Nigerian queer community needs, it's more joy, it's more community amongst, it's just, yeah, so I think that was like the highlight of this. Of also, I think the story also being like a Nebula finalist is one of, I'm grateful for that, because of like now there's more readership, more people are engaging with the work and seeing the possibilities that's out there.
So the book that I was a finalist for a Nebula for just last night is called Automatic Noodle. And it's about what happens when California wins a war of independence against the United States. FYI, California as a nation is also not great, but it's slightly better than the US. And what's happened is, I mean, this is in the future, and some of the robots who fought on the side of California in this war are given limited citizenship rights. So they're citizens of this new nation of California, but they're not allowed to vote. They're not allowed to form unions. They're not allowed to own property or have bank accounts. And there's some other limitations as well. And as I was writing it about these four little guys, these little robots who are under these conditions, I was thinking about, well, what would someone do in that circumstance? You know, they're a person, but they're told that they're a citizen, but they're also, they have their rights taken away. And what they decide to do is, through a series of very sneaky maneuvers, they figure out a way to take over a ghost kitchen and start making Biang Biang noodles, which are my favorite kind of noodle. This was a book I very much wrote to comfort myself. And I was just like, okay, I'm gonna think about noodles a lot. But also the book is about what it means to have a very precarious relationship to the place where you live. You know, you have a precarious visa, or you're undocumented, and it may be your home, but yet there are all of these limitations on your ability to stay there. And so I was thinking about kind of these more serious themes in the book as I was putting it together. It is a very gentle and cozy book, but it has this kind of shadow hanging over the story. And repeatedly, the feedback I've gotten on the book has been people telling me, oh my God, I discovered Biang Biang noodles. And people have told me they've like driven like 50 miles to find the local restaurant that serves them, because it's a Northwestern Chinese type of noodle, so you're not gonna just get it anywhere. And people told me they made them, they had book clubs where they read the book and ate the noodles. And honestly, it's made me so happy. People will send me pictures of their noodles, and like, it feels like what you're saying about there's joy in the midst of this difficulty. And that's really what the book is about, is like finding joy in something where you're nourishing each other and sharing. And so, yeah, that I think to me, just like keep sending me pictures of noodles and like I will be happy. Yeah, that really was gratifying as a writer.
I did not see where that story was going.
It surprised me too. I was like, that's what people are getting out of it? Good job. Like, if I can bring more Beyond Beyond Noodles to the world, my work is done.
Wow. Well, I love writing, and hopefully all of you do too. You know, sometimes it just feels really freeing, but then there are other times when it's not so freeing. It almost feels, I understand what that survivor was saying last night, feeling like this a burden over you. I felt that way when I did the memoir with my late mother, Freedom in the Family, because nonfiction is not my strong suit, and it was hard, period. Also challenging to write a book with your mother, you know, God bless her. We had some arguments, and I felt the same way about the reformatory. That took 7 years, but I just had to. I had to get it out. I'm wondering if you've had a project like that, that either exists already, is already out, congratulations, or that you are still fighting to bring out, that has been challenging and difficult, but it was something you felt you had to write.
I will say that I never find it freeing. It's really hard. Also, because in comics in particular, we're always on deadline. Like, I had two scripts due on Friday. Guess what? They're not done. So everything is challenging. Everything
I don't understand why not. What have you been doing?
I don't know, you know. they know they're getting it Monday or Tuesday. Yeah, I find everything challenging. And I think for me personally, if it's not challenging, I don't think I'm doing it right. Because if you're going to read it and it's fun and it's a kind of a fluffy thing, I don't think I'm doing my service to you or to me, because part of the reason I like doing this is that little bit, not just the noodles. I'm very happy when somebody discovers something like that, but also the theme there. I really enjoy being a little bit subversive. You think you're getting Red Sonja or some kind of sword and sorcery thing? No, you're getting a whole, like, you know, I like having that theme underneath, that you will get it whether you like it or not if I do my job correctly.
I like, you will get the theme whether you like it or not.
I get a lot of that because I do get a lot of, I'm sorry, right, the readers who read the comics when they were 12 and they're so curmudgeonly online and they come up to me at a show and be like, I didn't think I would like your writing, but I really did. And, you know, thank God you're not a feminist. I'm like, did you read the story? And because they're so conditioned to be reactive, right, that they actually are getting it. That's what I'm saying. They get it, but I just put it under a different mantle where they absorbed it without reacting to it.
I think that's what's difficult about nonfiction, actually, Tananarive, because I think, because like my most difficult book for sure that I've done is a book called Stories Are Weapons, which is a nonfiction book that's a history of psychological warfare and culture war in the United States. That was horrible to write because it's all, there's themes and they're right on the surface. Like they're the themes of like genocide and trying to, you know, imprison people for being, you know, for various fake reasons. And the US is super great actually at culture war and propaganda. It's actually one of our biggest exports. We're just really good
at
you know, trying to propagandize to other nations, but now to our own people. And it was really depressing. I had to read a lot of horrific stories about, especially in the 19th century during the Indian Wars, the ways that the US government not only murdered indigenous tribes but also and nations, but also engaged in all kinds of devious propaganda to try to minimize what they were doing or pretend like they weren't doing it. So that was dark and horrible. And I'm never going to work on a book like that again, but I needed to do it, and I'm glad that I did. And my next nonfiction book is an ancient history of parties. I'm going to focus parties now. But yeah, I'm glad that I did the propaganda first. What was your hardest one?
I used to do a lot of the party writing before, and I would write about all the things that made me so happy, or everybody's right about like bees. I just really liked bees for some reason. But I think in recent times I've been writing everything afraid, but writing them regardless. And I also think I'm now being a writer writing here in the US, I'm writing from a place of privilege, especially when
in the more thematic level, when I have characters, when my stories are like very queer, there are writers who are writing that in Nigeria and risking safety, risking community, and just doing the work regardless. And it's not that I am intentionally making my work political, or even if I was, what's wrong with that? But it's a choice I'm actively making, that this is what storytelling is demanding of me. This is what writing is demanding of me and at this point in time. And if this is how I can lend my voice, there are people out in the street, there are people out in the street protesting, there are people who are on television, there are people who are donating resources, putting their lives on the line. And if this is how I lend my own voice to the fight, then I will do that. And that's that. And on a more thematic level, that's how I've been trying my. We have seen a bit of like, and it's not really. I wouldn't say it's a struggle, but it's just, I don't know. It's a whole thing. On a more structural level, the act of writing itself, that I actively hate. The act of actually like, I need to write something today, and then you don't write it, and a month goes by and you've still not written anything, and it's like, I do say I am a writer, so why haven't I done this thing? I say, I currently started working on my very first novel, and that has been something. Normally I do short stories or novelettes, and it's also a struggle in itself, but at least you can just envision the future of the story wrapping up in a minute or a few days, but you just know you'll get to an ending. But with a novel, everyone keeps telling me, do not look back, it's crappy, it's ugly, but just keep going. And that's how do you, I can't do that. I have looked back like a dozen times and I've been stuck on those look backs. So now I see why they say don't look back. Because, we still keep doing it regardless. We still keep writing regardless. And yeah.
That's the beauty of it. The beauty and the pain, the joy and the pain of the writing. We have about 5 minutes, so I don't know if we have time for more than one question. But does anyone have a question? Because we do, yes. You need to shout it out, and then I might repeat it. Okay, did everyone hear, how do you create truth out of fiction at a time when the truth is being deliberately blurred?
I mean, it's a great question, and I think it's right to have an anxiety about that. The thing that's great about fiction is that it's labeled fiction. And one of the things that's really important that I really wish people would be taught more often in school is that there are two things, fiction and nonfiction. I mean, and then in the middle you have propaganda. I think when it's labeled as fiction, it gives you that freedom to trust that your reader understands that everything is made up, but there's a truth there in terms of the emotions, in terms of the kinds of stories that you're telling. Even if you're not trying to create, say, a world full of starships, you're still trying to create realistic emotional worlds inside your characters. And that's where I think a lot of the truth comes in, is when you're trying to report honestly on how it feels to do things. And I know that that is something I spend a lot of time thinking about with characters, is I imagine like someone in a situation, I'm like, what's a real way that someone would respond? Not like the way that a stereotyped way that they would respond, but like what would be the complexity of their feelings? And so I think that's one of the things we can do in fiction that really will resonate with readers and hit them as being truthful, is when we can actually say, this is how it genuinely feels to be someone who isn't you. And that's the beauty of storytelling, is getting to feel what it's like to be someone else. And maybe that changes how you act in the real world. Maybe you start to think about like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be a dick to that kind of person, because actually it really hurts them. That's a really basic example, but boy, we could sure use it.
I do think that fiction and lies and those kind of things, propaganda, are meant to make you feel comfortable. And truth, real truth, should make you feel uncomfortable. And if you're reading fiction and there's an underlying current in there that's making you question things, hopefully that's the truth that you tease out of that. I have a character in the Carmilla book, the third book, who is a the Chinese vampire, who's more like a zombie, I guess. And he's actually a Chinese miner who was lynched back in the day when they were lynched. And the Chinese zombies are zombies because they're trying to find their way home. And there's some history there. It's obviously a fictional character, but the actual history of what that character represents is truth. Like, if it, my hope is that you read it, you're entertained, but you ask questions and you do a little research and realize, oh, that was actually part of history. And that part hopefully makes you a little uncomfortable, is why did I not know the truth, right? And that's my hope, that what we do, ask questions, and you don't just ask ChatGPT, but you know, you do a little research and say, oh, there's a whole nother world out there that may have started out as fiction, but in fact has truth and has nonfiction roots to it.
Yeah, all of that.
That's the perfect response. All right, so are we wrapping up? That is our panel of Nebula finalists. We hope you had a good afternoon. Enjoy the rest of the fair.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you're notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.